The following is an encore presentation of Wordland. Hello, and welcome to Wordland. I'm your host, David Oates. This week is mostly performance poetry, slam, spoken word, with a couple of stories from Kevin Kling, and a sketch from the Second City Improv Company. Sean McNally is working the magic realism angle.
The plane goes down, and as the plane goes down, I turn to Dulcie and tell her, I'm more than a little fond of you, you know. That's what people do at a time like this, when the plane goes down. Sometimes the other person knows what you're trying to say, sometimes not, and sometimes the other person doesn't want to hear about it at all. So the plane goes down, this time in the middle of a soybean field in the middle of Ohio. Huh. So this is where they grow those, someone remarks. The crew unpacks the hot air balloons and makes ready the gondolas, most of them two-seaters. While we wait, they break out the handbell, Salvation Army surplus now, but I've heard they used to be classier, snazzier, more what you'd expect from a plane crash bell. We ring the bells in the old Kitty Hawk tradition. We ring them and shout, we crashed the plane! We crashed the plane! The crew, and some of them have been through this hundreds of times, call the response. Yes, you did! Yes, you did! Soon the balloons are ready and stocked with the usual provisions. Watermelons, French bread, prepackaged salads, a box of ho-hos, and the large jug with XXX on the label. This is my second major plane crash. The last time, the woman I shared a gondola with decided she didn't want to hang around anymore and used the sole parachute to take a hike. I made pretty heavy use of that jug then, I can tell you. Dulcie and I choose a red and green striped rig, and without much fanfare, we cast off. We rise above the ground as the crew bids us well and good luck. They're remaining behind to clean up the mess. They're getting smaller. Above us, already small and pushing against the clouds, are the balloons that left before us carrying other couples, some of them doing just fine, some of them in distress. I crack open the jug and Dulcie slices a watermelon. I'm trying to think of something to say to her. It always starts out the same when the plane goes down. Thank you.
The Plane Goes Down by Sean McNally from the CD Grand Slam. Edward Thomas Herrera had apparently heard a few victim poems before he wrote this.
My pain, my pain, my pain, my pain, my pain is better than anyone else's. My pain is more serious than anyone else's. My pain is more important than anyone else's. Compared to my pain, everyone else's pain is petty. Everyone else's pain is meaningless. Everyone else's pain is a day at the beach. A walk in the park, a f***ing piece of f***ing cake. It's my pain, my pain, my pain, my pain beating breast. My pain licking open sores. My pain crying. Thick red tears of arterial blood. My pain twisting the knife blade around and around and around. My pain representative of all the injustice that has ever happened, is happening, or will happen to anyone, anywhere, anyhow. My pain. My pain. My pain. I blame my lovers. I blame my parents. I blame organized religion. I blame the current administration. I blame the capitalist system of economics. But most importantly, I blame everyone who has ever lived. Because you have all been party to my torment. If not directly, then indirectly. If you don't believe me, just give me a little time. My pain, my pain, my pain. Some say I need to get over it. Transcend. Some say I need to put it all behind me, go on with my life. Some say I may require professional help in order to accomplish this. What do they know? They've never experienced my pain. My pain is so truly, enormously unique. If I didn't dwell on it, who would? My pain, my pain, my pain. Boy, howdy, does the world owe me but big time. Allows me to be bitter and resentful towards those who have caused my suffering, towards those who do not share my suffering, towards those who have not heard about my suffering. My pain releases me from the responsibility of having to accomplish anything with my life, because I can always blame my failure on my status as a member of a socially disenfranchised group of people. My pain makes me the most important person in this room. And if you don't agree, it's because you don't understand and there's something horribly, horribly wrong with you. Thank you.
Edward Thomas Herrera from the National Poetry Slam Competition in San Francisco. Slam founder Mark Smith's core values informed this next.
I'm for the little guy. Blue, black, tan, gray, green, red, white. I'm for the guy that lost the fight that day on the schoolyard when the bully stole the nerd's hat. And the nerd let him have it. The hat, that is. And it wasn't right. The man did fight. So the little guy, nobody, stepped forward and said, hey, you can't do things like that. And the bully laughed, oh yeah? Watch this. And pushed little guy nobody's face into the chain link fence, massaged it there, while the nerd looked on mewling, it's only a hat, it's only a hat. To the little guy nobody had had enough of being a hero, feeling the knots of the chain link fence cut into his cheeks, and called it quits. I'm for that guy, walking away feeling like, feeling as if he'd lost something, losing to a guy twice his size. Because in the movies, a real hero chops those bullies down, rights the situation. But it never worked out that way for this kid, righteous though he was. And in his lifetime, he found out that the bullies were always winning, and the nerds were always helpless. And caught between them, forever pathetically engaged, were guys like him, trying to set things right, trying to undo the damage, trying to live in accordance with ancient ideals that even in ancient times must have been just that, ideals. But what the hell, I'm for him, whoever he is, because even today, when it comes to a stolen hat, a stolen chance, a stolen you name it, he steps right forward, come what may, and says, hey, you can't do things like that.
Mark Smith, for the little guy. Boston's Patricia Smith won the National Individual Slam title several times. Here's why.
Spinning until you get dizzy, for Dizzy Gillespie. It was never control we were after. Jazz, by ragged definition, pump-started its own heart, sensed the possibilities of chaos long before it became Brown Baby Lullaby, the ripples that pulse on the surface of whiskey. Jazz demanded the unleashing of so many souls, turned order into impetuous melody, chords which blew spit at their captors, and there was nowhere to run, and even fewer places to hide. What gave birth to jazz? What moist, constricted passage it struggled from? Who held it aloft, slapped that newborn ass, and sparked the glorious screaming? Does it matter? What matters is fluid lines shredding into scat, and us owning that sweetness. What matters is cigarette-thin men swearing at their reflections in the bar top. What matters is sugar browns hitching up homemade skirts and pounding holes into the dance floor, out past curfew and tired of asking the time. What matters is the bee in the bonnet of bebop, curses swirling from the mouth of a sax, blues trapped in cool column of clarinet, twisting the guitar string throat, and mojo rising up from the brown battered skin of drums. There is growling in all of this. A warning for you to stop and shout hallelujah wherever you are. A warning to stop and shout praise to all that is cool and raunchy. A warning to be thankful for complication. And let somebody else answer when the disbelieving asks, who is Jazz's mama? What ripe woman body curved and struggled and pushed that hard-headed boy into the light? And somewhere, the bell of a horn curved up. Because it was not about control. It was never about maybe brown babies in sequins and hardback chairs. Jazz was never capture or compliance. It was all about the possibilities of chaos. And he never bothered straightening the bell on that horn, because why shouldn't heaven get the gospel too? What he blew upset us, soured our gentle stomachs. I mean, what did we need with music that thrived in blue light, music with rumbling in its feet? We begged it to go away, banned it on the airwaves, but as usual, the heat in our hips spoke otherwise. Didn't want to do, didn't know how to do, could never do without it. Those cocky, seamless blasts that rocked us to rolling, because it was not about control. It was never about control. It was about the bell of a horn curved up. Not Jazz's mama, but her son. All rough chin and shark skin. A black beret on cool kinks. Never a note to apologize for. And such outrageous cheap.
Patricia Smith for Dizzy, from By Someone's Good Grace. Lisa Buscani was an individual champ and a frequent contender for the title when Patricia Smith was the queen of the slam.
Okay. Quite frankly, I'm tired of being loud. And so this is my last piece of the evening, and I offer it to you. It's called A Prayer. The difference between a rant and a prayer lies only in position and delivery. Raising yourself to the skies, facing either the biggest laugh or the only great eye. Hands up and open in surrender or supplication, or fisted in the fiercest demand. The voice modulated between a thick strangle or the soft, humble hang time of pleading. Personally, I prefer prayer. It's not that I know that someone's up there. It's that I can't bear to think that there's not. Prayer is the knot at the end of the rope that keeps you from finally falling. Prayer is the tug at the robe of a myth that stands over your shoulder with its comforting color and irritating politics. Prayer is small and tentative and set against the whispering background of hope. And so we pray. You, rage-cropped father, you, earth-stained mother, you, flaming spirit, you, laughing jackal, you, rising bird, you, knowing shadow, you, inner being. I won't kneel, because that'll bring me closer to what defeats me now. I won't bow, because I can't cower in the face of a question. But I can ask. And hear my plea split the air and take comfort in the fact that I still have the strength to want. I'm tired. Clichés about weight aside, the world has nested on my shoulders, settling down for a long winter's nap. My life follows the coldest road, dark and indifferent and quite happy to roll on without me. And sometimes I feel like I'm the only rider, and that rests in me so heavily I can only sit down and hope for a deep breath. You, who know the true meaning of the word beyond, you who hold the lives of so many in your strange justice. You who promise that this life will be justified. Send some of that foggy old narcotic down my way, can't you? And let me step back a while. I ask for peace, I ask for patience, I ask for health, I ask for truth, I ask for beauty, I ask for company, I ask for love. Amen. Omen. Whatever.
Lisa Buscani,
Prayer from the CD Grand Slam. This next is from Taylor Molly's CD Conviction.
How falling in love is like owning a dog. First of all, it's a big responsibility. So think long and hard before deciding on love. On the other hand, love gives you a sense of security. When you're walking down the street late at night and you've got a leash on love, ain't nobody gonna mess with you, because crooks and muggers think love is unpredictable. Who knows what love could do in its own defense? On cold winter nights, love is warm. It lies between you and lives and breathes and makes funny noises. Love wakes you up at all hours of the night with its needs. It needs to be fed so it can grow and stay healthy. Love doesn't like being left alone for long, but come home and love is always happy to see you. It may break a few things in its passion for living, but you can never be mad at love for long. Is love good all the time? No. No. Love can be bad. Bad love. Bad. Very bad love. Love makes messes. Love leaves little surprises here and there. Love needs lots of cleaning up after. Sometimes you just want to get love fixed. Sometimes you want to roll up a piece of newspaper and swat love on the nose, not so much to cause pain, just to let love know, don't you ever do that again. Sometimes love just wants to go on a nice, long walk because love loves exercise. It runs you around the block and leaves you panting. It pulls you in several different directions at once and winds around and around you until you're all wound up and can't move. But love makes you meet people wherever you go. People who have nothing else in common but love stop to talk to each other on the street. Throw something away, and love will bring it back again and again and again. But most of all, love needs love, lots of it. And in return, love loves you and never stops.
After Billy Collins' Carnegie Hall reading, he took questions from the audience.
I don't know if that would leave anyone curious, but maybe you're completely satisfied. But if you had a question or two, I know we've been going on for a while. It's very nice to see all of you, actually. I've just been looking into these headlights here. Yes?
Could you say a little about the deal breakers that keep you from reading a poem?
About
someone else's, of course.
Right. About deal breakers that keep me from reading a poem, that I will stop. Well, the word cicada. I won't tolerate that. I'm just sick of them. So if I'm reading a poem and I come across the word cicada, stop. Deal breaker. It's off. That's it. I mean, that's one easy one to answer, but... I guess the other poems that I tend not to finish are poems in which that I don't know, they exhibit a kind of presumptuousness in that the first couple of lines, I feel like I'm suddenly in an ambulance with someone and he or she is being taken to the psychiatric ward and is telling me about some inner psychic terror that they're suffering from without having really introduced themselves. And that seems to be a form of kind of, you know, psychological bad manners. So I appreciate poems that kind of, you know, that are kind of clear and then mysterious. And I think poems that work for me are poems in which a writer really appreciates and understands the difference between when to be clear, what to be clear about and what to be mysterious about. So like what cards to turn over and what cards to leave face down. And if you leave all the cards face down, I mean, some poems read that way to me, there's really no game. It's just kind of 52 bits of obscurity. And if you turn them all over, it's just too obvious. So I think the manipulation of the clear and the mysterious in the right way are deal makers for me. So is there any, was that the only, that's the only question. Oh, here's some.
With your poetry 180, I know you have the second one coming out and all. Have you had any feedback from any of the schools and all that, instead of having to analyze and all that?
Just having them? Oh, huge. Yeah. I mean, we put out started a Poetry 180 website when I was Poet Laureate, which I described as this kind of poetry jukebox on the internet, and I wanted high schools to simply hear a poem a day and not have to analyze it. I thought students would be, always felt that they were put on the spot when they heard a poem, because as soon as the teacher finished the last line, it was time to avoid eye contact of any, you know, just drop your pencil or something, because then it was time that, I mean, you were now accountable for kind of saying something about this poem. So the response has been very good. We had a guest book, which is kind of off and on, but hundreds of high schools have signed up in the guest book, and I get just tons of anecdotal good responses from teachers who have found that it really works to teach poetry chronologically backwards. And if they start by throwing out bits of bait, so to speak, that students will be we'll grab one of them and maybe go on to read other poems. So thanks for asking, Uncle Charlie. It's been very successful. You were supposed to ask that a little later in the procedure, but someone here.
I'm wondering if by any chance you were envious of the British poet laureate when he got to write the poem about Charles and Camilla's wedding.
Well,
and
if only.
I'm wondering if you ever had such a job like that when you had your position.
If only. No, I've met Andrew Motion, and I mentioned in this Poetry 180 book, I think, that we had this dinner together, and we compared job descriptions, and his job description came with the obligation to write these occasional poems on the death of a viscount, or right after he was named laureate, the Queen Mother died, so he had to write a quick elegy for her, and now he's come up with this epithalamion, would be the word of the day, right? This wedding poem for Charles and Camilla. It's hard to say that with an American accent. So no, I never, the American Poet Laureate just has to write occasionally, not occasional poems. And so I actually thought that poem in the Times wasn't bad, though. I mean, he kind of used nature, as we tend to do. He kind of, you know, stood behind and sort of waved some ferns and let nature do the talking. I thought it was okay for the very difficult task, right? So, sir, or yes,
Coltrane gets his horn to speak. In fact, in A Love Supreme, the last movement of the suite, he's reciting a poem that he himself wrote. When you write a poem for the reader, it seems to me that you have to divorce yourself from your wonderful speech melodies and speech rhythms. And it's been such a great opportunity to hear your poems sung by you tonight. But how do you do that? How do you separate yourself out from your speech rhythms and trust that we, the readers, will bring that melody to it in some way?
Well, I disagree. You know, I mean, I think they are speech rhythms. I don't think I'm vocalizing. I think I'm trying to do just as precedents, as Wordsworth and Frost and others did, which was try to get poetry back to listening to be poetry that would be built on speech rhythms and sentence rhythms, and the natural syntax and grammar of English has its own music. And I think so you don't need to turn a poem into like a sort of Swinburne sound symphony, but simply using minimal easel, just using, not using too many modifiers is always good. I think as young poets, we try to smother the noun with all these modifiers, but the modifier often kills the noun. So simple vocabulary and then just listening to the speech rhythms of the language, I think is enough music to help a poem along. So maybe one more question, and then it's getting warm. This is like 90 or something.
Yeah. Hi. My fiance and I just recently bought the house that I think you grew up in White Plains, New York.
Wow. God bless you.
I know.
Right. Do you have visitors there? Or?
We just bring people through. That's how we pay for the house. Just wanted to know what childhood memories you had from that house. And that.
Mostly basketball. Mostly just playing basketball by myself. I am an only child, and so so that's your sort of stuck with that. Basically just endless playing basketball, and after it got dark, but you could still see the hoop, and then being called in for dinner. But that was basically just dribbling and shooting and dribbling and more shooting.
So you had a hoop off the garage there?
Yeah. But we'll have to. We should talk later about this. Thank you for coming.
Billy Collins, Q and A.
Now, two read by Kenneth Coke, the first written by Juan Garcia, the second Coke's own, from the Academy of American Poets recording.
This is by Juan Garcia, a young poet who's very radical and has rejected Guglielmi's political views, but has obviously been influenced by him prosodically. One may wish to slaughter or to save the bull, but first one must master the cape. With the politics, I differ. For the man, I feel nothing but love. Without him, I might never have been a poet. His aesthetic discoveries were powerful enough to enable me to dispute with him to the death in an arena where the combat is eternal, the arena of poetry. Watercress Street. A humble street. I see a girl. She has orange sleeves, orange dress, orange shoes. You belong on Orange Street. No, I don't, says she.
Playwright Karen Wuerl spent several years on the Athens Poetry Slam team. She lives in Austin now, but dreams of a bigger change.
Давай познакомимся, Россия. I want to live in Russia because everyone's poor. I want to live in Russia because I will wear a long black coat all year long. I want to live in Russia because the men drink vodka. I want to live in Russia because the men don't sip wine. I want to live in Russia despite Dr. Zhivago. I want to live in Russia because I can say, Что это? Это твоя книга? Я студентка. Где чемодан? У меня есть новые носки. What's this? Is this your book? I am a student. Where is the suitcase? I have new socks. I want to live in Russia because Chekhov was a babe. I want to live in Russia because they deified the Tsar. I want to live in Russia because they killed the Tsar. I want to live in Russia because of samovars, troikas, potatoes, and cabbage. I want to live in Russia because I have no ex-boyfriends living in Russia. Yet. I want to live in Russia because the icons are beautiful. I want to live in Russia because I don't want a cell phone. I want to live in Russia because Russians weep openly and with very little provocation. Just read the stage directions for the cherry orchard sometime. I want to live in Russia because of diminutives and patronyms. I want to live in Russia and marry a man named Vasily Dmitrievich or Dmitry Evgenievich or Evgeny Nikolaevich or Nikolai Yurievich or Yuri Grigorovich or Grigory Yegorovich or Yegor Ilyich or Ilya Yosefovich or Yosef Mikhailovich or Mikhail Pavlovich or Pavel Sergeyevich or Sergei Vasilievich. I'm not particular. So I can hang around the apartment, which we share with 7 or 8 other people, making tea in the samovar and calling him Vasha, or Dima, or Mitya, or Zhenya, or Kolya, or Yura, or Grisha, or Yegorushka, or Ilyusha, or Osha, or Misha, or Pasha, or Seryozha, depending. And we will be poor and drink vodka and weep. I want to live in Russia and be a casualty of capitalism. I want to live in Russia because I'm a casualty of capitalism. I want to live in Russia so I can dream of America.
Karen Wirl's I Want to Move to Russia. Former National Slam champion Taylor Molly is strict about his students' use of English.
I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Lily Wilson at my office door. Lily Wilson, the recovering like addict, the worst I've ever seen, so like bad that the entire 8th grade started calling her like Lily, like Wilson, like, until I made my classroom a like-free zone, and she could not speak for days. But when she finally did, it was to say, Mr. Molly, this is so hard. Now I have to think before I say anything. Imagine that, Lily. It's for your own good, even if you don't like it. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Lily Wilson at my office door. Lily is writing a research paper for me about how homosexuals should not be allowed to adopt children. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's like Lily, like Wilson, at my office door. She's having trouble. She's having trouble finding sources, which is to say, ones that back her up. They all argue in favor of what I thought I was against. And it took 4 years of college, 3 years of graduate school, and every incidental teaching experience that I have ever had to let out only... Well, that's a real interesting problem, Lily. But what do you propose to do about it? That's what I want to know. And the 8th grade mind is a beautiful thing. Like a newborn baby's face, you can often see it change before your very eyes. I can't believe I'm saying this, Mr. Molly, but I think I'd like to switch sides. And I want to tell her to do more than just believe it, but to enjoy it. That changing your mind is one of the best ways of figuring out whether or not you still have one, or even that minds are like parachutes, that it doesn't matter what you pack them with, so long as they open at the right time. Oh, God, Lily, I want to say, you make me feel like a teacher, and who could ask to feel more than that? I want to say all of this, but I manage only. Lily, I am, like, so impressed with you. So I finally taught somebody something, namely how to change her mind. And I learned in the process that if I ever change the world, it's going to be 1 8th grader. At a time.
Like Lily, Like Wilson by Taylor Molly from the Like Free Zone CD. Kevin Kling knows the pleasures of aesthetic investment.
I learned about being an artist during Ms. Keller's 3rd grade class. Through the luck of alphabetized seating, I was able to watch Robin Johnson create a series of paintings of her house. During show and tell, Robin showed the picture she painted of her house, and they didn't look anything like her house, but she was a way better artist than the house she had to live in, so we let it go. I loved her pictures. The colors, the eye for detail, the confidence in the composition. I had to have one of her houses, so I paid my lunch money for it. Then I learned how good it felt to own art and to support somebody I admired. That lunch money prompted Robin to create more houses she never lived in, and in no time, most of the 5th grade lockers housed Johnsons. I felt proud. I remember the first piece of art I ever sold. I was in college. One night I saw Audrey, a flute player with the band, sitting at a local pub with a friend. I introduced myself and announced I also had an interest in the arts, that I had shown quite an aptitude in a drawing class. Audrey seemed preoccupied, but her friend wanted to know if I had some sketches back in my room. Why, yes, I do. I do have sketches back in my room. She then wondered if I'd show her my portfolio. Of course, and we were off. When we got to my room, I took out my portfolio, and to a somewhat surprised Audrey's friend, I displayed my sketches, especially the human figures, and how the hands and feet give me the most trouble, as you can see by the shoes and mittens. She was impressed. And then, when I felt the evening couldn't get any better, she said she wanted to, you know, buy a painting. Of course, I said. Then she leaned into me and whispered, "It feels good to buy art," I said. "I know." I've never forgotten that evening. That evening I knew I was a professional artist. The first performance art I ever bought was a viewing of Mary Gilligan's appendix scar during recess behind the brick pump house. It challenged me.
Kevin Kling, buying art from his CD Wonder Lure. My alma mater spent some time with no football team, so when we re-entered the arena, it was a bit of a culture shock.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to an evening from the Second City. Tonight, the scenes that we're going to perform have been worked on by the actors through and by improvisational techniques and then set for the performance. Now, the Second City, of course, refers to Chicago, and one of Chicago's great landmarks is the University of Chicago, a university that certainly had a long line of great chancellors. Perhaps one of the greatest chancellors was Mr. Lawrence Kimpton, because he vowed that he was going to bring football back to the University of Chicago. Well, he did not. And now we'd like to show you perhaps a few reasons why he did not in a scene called Football Comes to the University of Chicago.
Raise the flag for old Chicago, show them how we stand.
Excuse me, sir.
La-da-dee-da-da-da-da,
bum-bum.
Yes?
Is this Football 202?
Yes, it is. Hello there. Come right in.
You must be Dr. Harden.
Oh, no. Coach Harden's my name.
Very pleased to meet you, sir.
Very nice to meet you. What's your name?
Pim, sir.
Pim?
Alejandro Pim.
Mm-hmm. And you want to play football, Pim?
Oh, yes, sir. I'm here to learn.
Well, I'm here to teach you. And what are you studying here at the university?
Music, sir.
Music? Well, looking you over, maybe I can make a fullback out of you. Well, we'll see about that. Have you played much football?
Not in this life, sir, no.
Football 202?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Dr. Harden.
Oh, Coach Harden, I'm afraid.
How do you do, sir? My name is Throckmorton.
Throckmorton, how do you
do? Morton Throckmorton, yes, sir. I'm in theology.
Theology?
Yes, sir.
Well, and you want to play football?
Indeed, I trust I may, sir, yes.
Well, I think you can, Throckmorton. Yes, indeed. You look to me to be about, I'd say about 195.
Would you really, sir? Mm-hmm.
You weigh about 195?
Oh, I thought you meant my IQ. No,
well, I'll make you quarterback then. Oh, hello there. Getting bigger and bigger here. Yes,
have you gotten a Morgenstern?
No, not here. You might try down the hall, but boy, I'd hate to lose you, I must say. Wow.
No, I am Morgenstern.
Oh, you're Morgenstern. I'm sorry about that. It's rather confusing, you know. Very glad to meet you.
Very glad to meet you, Doctor.
Coach.
Dr. Coach.
How do you do?
Morgenstern. My name is Tim.
Sit down, gentlemen. Sit down and relax here.
Thank you. May I ask, Morgenstern, what field are you in?
History of arithmetic.
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, I trust you gentlemen are here to play football. Is that it?
Indeed, we trust we are, sir. Yes.
Well, let's get started here. I'd like to go over, first of all, some of the basics with you. As you probably know, football is played on a football field roughly 30 by 100 yards long.
Roughly, sir.
Hmm? Roughly 30 by
100. Oh, I see what you mean, Morgenstern. My diagram's a little off there. No, on the field, you'll find it's 100 yards long.
Exactly.
Yes.
I can accept that.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. You're going to have to, all right? Now, also, gentlemen, I put some yard lines on the board. I'd like to point out
something
about
this. Excuse me, sir. Yes? Do those yard lines bear any reference to the treble and bass clef?
Not in this life, no. No, that, of course, wouldn't be a musical staff. That's a football field. Of course, you wouldn't play here on the blackboard. You play out of doors.
Oh, sir.
All right, here we go. Let's take a hypothetical case, gentlemen. Let's say we have the ball on the 47-yard line.
Oh, sir.
Yeah.
Hate to interrupt.
It's all right.
But the things you keep calling lines.
Yard lines, yes.
Yes. If those were really lines, they'd be infinite. Hmm? They'd go all the way out to the end of the universe and make the game very long and tedious.
Well, what do you call them, then?
Those are line segments.
I can accept that, Morgenstern. We have the ball, gentlemen, on the 47-yard line segment here. And you notice I'm putting some circles on the board here.
Yes, sir, I did notice those. Those are not really circles. Those are ellipsoids, but let it pass.
Oh, Dr. Harden, sir, would I be correct in assuming that these ellipsoids you've drawn represent a group acting in concert for the common good?
Why not?
Sure.
We're going down the field for a touchdown, all right?
Yes, sir.
All right, the ellipsoids have the ball. And they're playing the crosses up above here, you'll notice.
Ah, crosses, sir.
So we'll make them X's, all right? The ellipsoids are playing the X's here.
Oh, I see, sir. And in this particular equation, what do the X's represent?
Well, that's your opponent, the defense. We're using a 6-2-2 here, you
notice. I imagine that each X has the same power, though.
No, the tackles are heavier. I'll put little curlicues on them, all right? Yeah. The guards are lighter. Put little dots over there. The ends are taller.
Look what you've just notated there.
What have I notated? Well,
that's Bacchianus Brasiliaris, number 5, right? By Bill Robles.
Oh, no, that's my place. Oh, no, 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 stop that. No, no, sit down. No, no. No, no, it's nonsense. Ridiculous, yeah. No, you can't sing those guards like that.
Those are whole notes.
Those are not whole. No, they are whole notes at that. I never noticed that. We've got a whole backfield full of whole notes there. It's ridiculous, isn't it? No, actually, coincidence, really. What that is a naked reverse. You'll notice the ball. Morgenstern, you seem to be grasping this. Tell Pim there what a naked reverse is.
A naked reverse?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that would be turning around, bare ass.
I must admit, though, that certainly an interesting conception. I never really had thought about that. No, you wear a uniform.
Oh, all right, here we go.
All right, gentlemen, a little football here. Here's a little ball. Will we have a little practice, all right?
Oh, that's not actually round, is it, sir?
No, it's a demi polytetrahedron.
Oh, no. No, it's not. That's a Spalding. They put that up.
It's a very good ball.
I believe that it's made out of some sort of animal skin.
Very interesting point, Pim. As a matter of fact, gentlemen, the football has had a fascinating history. It used to be made from the skin of a pig. The old pig skin, we call it. Now it's made from the skin of a calf.
Aha! Well, that's understandable, sir.
Yes, sir. Really? I'm sure that Mr. Throckmorton here could tell us why.
Of course I can, yes.
All right, Throckmorton, tell us why.
Why, the Moslems wouldn't be able to touch it, sir.
And, of course, the Jews wouldn't be able to eat it, but that's...
Oh, no! Gentlemen, you don't have to worry about that. We're not playing any of those schools, huh?
Oh? Here we go. Is there some sort of prejudice here?
No prejudice. We just have a very tight schedule. Oh, now stop this. Now, let's start playing football here. Pim, you're out there. All right, Throckmorton, center here. Here's our set.
Why are you trying to bend me, sir?
Well, you have to bend over to the ball.
Oh,
you remember that?
No, well, if I must, of course.
Yes, you must, all right? Oh, we're going to use a balance line here, gentlemen. We'll have two guards, of course. Left guard, right tackle, left end, and right end. You got all that?
A lot of company here.
Company,
yes.
Sir?
Yes.
Where are the beginnings for those ends?
Right here. Throckmorton's our beginning.
Sir, I have a sciatic condition.
Well, I'm sorry, right here. Throckmorton's our beginning.
He is in the center or middle.
That's right. He's our center.
And you can't very well begin in the middle.
Oh, we do. Right
no, you have to have a beginning, go through the middle to get to the end.
Who says so?
Aristotle.
And who did he play for?
Oh, Alexander the Great, Philip of Macedon, that whole crowd.
St. Thomas Aquinas said the same thing, sir.
Oh, Notre Dame boy. All right, fine. We'll make Mr. Morgenstern left beginning, then, all right? Oh, yes, Throckmorton. Yes. Sir, overlook something there.
Indeed.
Remember, you're out on that field, you've got to center that ball.
Yes, sir.
Now, remember, across that line segment from you are 7 big, heavy opponents.
Oh, big fat man.
Yeah. Big, vicious man. They want that ball, too, and they're coming across that line segment, they're going to smear you, all right?
Well, surely we can discuss it, sir.
I'll be happy to give them the ball.
No, don't give them the ball. The idea is to keep the ball. Rules of the game.
Oh, rules of the game, of
rules
course.
Of the game.
Yes, right. Like chess.
Oh? No, it's not like chess, Morgan.
Like Monopoly.
Now, Pam, you're in here. All right, you're out there, Morgenstern. Now, what you're going to do is you're down, Throckmorton. We'll start to play. You're going to shift in here like this. You got that?
Yes, sir.
You get the ball like this. Come right up here and through, Throckmorton. And get the ball to Morgenstern. And then you take the ball, Morgenstern, and go around your own end. All right, here we go.
Oh, sir. About going around my own end.
Yes.
Of course, geometrically, it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But anatomically, you see...
All right, then go round your own beginning. I don't care.
Dr. Harden, sir, there's nothing I'd rather do than center this ball for you.
Go ahead and do it.
I'm afraid I may not be able to, sir. You see, every time I bend over, the blood rushes to my head. Oh, and I have a sinus infection, sir. All eight of them are draining.
Oh, really? Well, try not to drain on the ball, will you, Throckmorton?
Yes, sir. All right, here we go. Ready, pair. Signals. Shift.
Well, we'll work on that, all right?
For now, just cup your hands like this. Put them together like that. Just come right up here tight. You put your hands between his legs, you get the ball like that, and you hand it off to Morgenstern. You got all that? All right, here we go. Ready. Signals. One, two, three. Hi!
What's happening?
Don't stop. You got to go right up in and get that ball. Right off the hike. All right, here we go. One, two, three. Hi! No, don't go like that. Come right up directly and get the ball. Right up.
We'll get the ball.
Oh, no, no. Stop that. You can't go around front like that. That tackle will come through there and smear you.
Dr. Harden, I think he's trying to eliminate my function.
That's right. Oh, he's got a job to do here.
Your function was to be smeared by those vicious hands.
Stop that. No. Just come over here. There's no function involved. Just do your job. Now, come right up here. Get the ball. Right off his hip there and right into the mortgage journal. Let's go, Tim. You can do it. Right in there. Drive hard. Right up in there. Singles. One, two, three. Hey. Oh, come on. Now, open your eyes. Open your eyes. You can't see the ball if you don't open your eyes.
Hurry, man. I'm draining.
Hurry up. He's draining. No. Turn around. Look at him. Just right up in here. Right up here.
I can't do it. I cannot do it.
You can't do it. Of course you can do it. Why not?
I hardly know him.
Football comes to the University of Chicago as imagined by the Second City Improv Company from their album The Second City Writhes Again. Playwright Kevin Kling draws his stories from life. Sometimes he doesn't have to look very far.
On these last warm days of September, as the salads slowly turn into casseroles here in Minnesota, I know as soon as the leaves turn golden on my maple out front, it's time to go to the garage for the rake, because by the time I get back to the tree, all the leaves will be on the ground. Each one of these sultry days feels like a gift, and as with any free gift that you're not sure why you got, there's a bit of guilt attached that makes you want to enjoy it to the hilt. I think of my Uncle Johnny. He's passed on now, but nobody epitomized summer like Uncle Johnny. I can still picture him on hot summer days perched on his aluminum lawn chair, holding court, framed by the proscenium of his open garage door, a Schlitz tall boy permanently attached to his hand. Every chair Uncle Johnny sat in seemed to be made for him. My Uncle Don used to say, "Kev, your Uncle Johnny smells all the roses all the time." I remember one time Johnny pointed at his dog. He had all kinds of dogs, all mutts, all named Poochie, and Johnny never threw away an old car, no. He simply parked it in the back and it became another doghouse. Anyway, he points at his dog, Poochie, and says, "Look at that darn dog, Kev. Been staring at that dead butterfly for 2 hours now. 2 hours. And I ought to know. I've been watching it the whole time." He takes a big swig of Schlitz and keeps staring at the dog. Johnny reminds me of Pa Kettle from those Ma and Pa Kettle movies. When Ma would ask Pa, "What are you going to do today?" "Well, I thought I'd give a whirl at getting dressed." Johnny had a Harley Davidson motorcycle, but I never saw him ride it. I saw him look at it a lot and talk about riding it and the times they'd had, but he said, "When you get to be my age, about all you got left is show and tell." His t-shirt reads, "Live to eat, eat to ride." Johnny's main love was barbecue, not ribs or chicken or burgers, no. Johnny was into pork shoulder sandwiches. He'd say, "Now, I got nothing against vegetarians. Some of my favorite foodstuffs are vegetarians." But he'd tell me to beware the terrible teas, as he called them. Tofu, tamari, tahini, tabbouleh. He'd say, "That kind of food will kill you from boredom." Johnny carefully applies more wood chips to the fire. They've soaked in water in order to burn real slow and provide the smoke that flavors the meat. Barbecue is the reason God put smoke with fire, but it burns my eyes and I have to look away. Johnny stays in the center of the curling smoke. It's a small price to pay, and he knows to reach paradise, one must occasionally dance with the devil. The meat looks done to me, but Johnny says there's a few hours left to go. A few hours! But a few hours means nothing to Johnny. This meat has already gone through days of rigorous preparations of dry rubs, peppers, garlic, herbs, and marinades of onions, celery, fruit juices, all lending a subtle ambience to the aura of ambrosia. Then out to Johnny's smoker, thick with soot and grease. Boys, there's three things I never wash, and one's my grill. And the meat enters the inferno to be cleansed by smoke and fire. Slow cooking is the key. And when the meat is done to perfection, Uncle Johnny chops up the shoulder on a big board out back, piles it high on slices of Wonder Bread, scoops on the sauce, and a big heap in helping a coleslaw. The Wonder Bread disintegrates in 2 seconds, and I know there's other breads or buns that are sturdy enough to hold the soggy mess together, but it's got to be Wonder Bread, and on a thin paper plate that threatens to fold in half at any minute. When the sandwich is secured, I take a bite and goodbye, world. How do you like it, boys? Gives you good ballast for riding the road. I dream of owning a Harley someday like Uncle Johnny, and for this reason my mom tends to discourage our association with him. Now these days, I bite into my barbecue and Wonder Bread sandwich, and man, Uncle Johnny, how did you do it? I try and try, but I can't seem to get that taste, and it's in me, I can feel it. I mean, we're related, and I know this knowledge has been passed on somehow. I also know that part of the joy of a place is in the getting there. And I'm getting closer, thanks to a book I found. It's called Barbecuing with Bobby by Bobby Seale. Bobby Seale was the leader of the Black Panthers for a while, and I'm pretty sure he and Uncle Johnny may have had their differences. But I also know that in both their Bibles, Abraham's knife came down on the same pork shoulder, and one day, by the grace of God, I'll find it too.
Kevin Kling's Uncle Johnny from his collection Wonder Lure. Karen Wuerl has realized a common goal, but it's complicated.
This one is called I Met a Nice Man. So I'm calling to tell you I met a nice man. Just like you said when I told you I loved you, you said I would meet a nice man someday. I think we're an item. He's a public radio kind of guy. He's gonna keep me under consideration. He's gonna hold me in suspense. He's gonna thank me for my submission. He's gonna mortify me by mail. He's not gonna put me in his mouth. He doesn't know where I've been, though I've told him. I drew him a map. It looked like the MARTA. He's not into public transportation. I left a message. He left a message. I have no proof of our existence admissible in a court of law. He's got my number. They've all got my number. I am unpublished, but I'm common knowledge. I try to reach you, but I'm calling up memories. All these numbers have been disconnected. This speed dial graveyard, this line I use, touch tone access to nothing, 'cause you're a ghost, and the dead don't return their calls. I stop by your place because I don't know my place. You're always out because the dead don't stay home. You're number 13 at the end of the hall, the last stop on this block. I've been around once or twice. A blank white door I'm on the outside of. A knock-knock joke without a punchline. A sight gag for the blind. I know you by heart. I still don't get you. So this time I really met a nice man like you said I would meet 100 times. Nice men are a dime a dozen. I met 100 if I met 10, if I met my quota. Some of them don't remind me of you, never shot heroin even. Some of them return my calls. Some return me unread like a manuscript they can tell without reading I won't fit the margins. Others have edited into the night and left me condensed like a reader's digest blurb. I lose a little something in the translation. Like I can't remember what you look like when I can't sleep at night anymore, and I can't remember why I want to call you and tell you anything, everything. I can't remember what I look like, who I am without you, my shattered mirror, broken angel, darling ghost. Hey, now listen. I'm leaving you a message. I'm leaving you, this time for good, and that's tentative. I mean it.
I Met a Nice Man by Karen Wuerl. This one is one of mine. It's called News.
The governor accepts full responsibility for the succotash, but fires his secretary of buttered vegetables. A cocker spaniel wants to make it in rock and roll, so he's working on his hair and his clothes. He has a potent whine, a suggestive growl, and those eyes, baby. The first model wears a dress of baked lima beans and cheddar cheese sauce. Everyone with the necessary $2,000 will be wearing one soon. Of course, it won't do in this outfit to stand too close to the buffet. A pork chop dreams of becoming president. 3 years before the election, the polls have him at 32%. An alarm clock stands on the 12-story ledge, no longer able to take the verbal and physical abuse. A desperate band of poodles captures the jet plane and holds the hot dogs hostage. Thinking the terrorists are unarmed, the SWAT team closes in but freezes when the pilot radios, "They've got mustard."
That was my fault.
Billy Collins has a skill of sounding conversational while making a remarkable piece of writing. He's been called the first stand-up poet.
The first dream. The wind is ghosting around the house tonight, and as I lean against the door of sleep, I begin to think about the first person to dream, how quiet he must have seemed the next morning, as the others stood around the fire, draped in the skins of animals, talking to each other only in vowels, for this was long before the invention of consonants. He might have gone off by himself to sit on a rock and look into the mist of a lake as he tried to tell himself what had happened, how he had gone somewhere without going, how he had put his arms around the neck of a beast the others could touch only after they had killed it with stones, how he felt its breath on his bare neck. Then again, the first dream could have come to a woman, though she would behave, I suppose, in much the same way, moving off by herself to be alone near water, except that the curve of her young shoulders and the tilt of her downcast head would make her appear to be terribly alone. And if you were there to notice this, you might have gone down as the first person to ever fall in love with the sadness of another. Morning. Why would anyone bother with the rest of the day? The swale of the afternoon, the sudden dip into evening, then night with his notorious perfumes, his many pointed stars. This is the best, throwing off the light covers, feet on the cold floor, and buzzing around the house on espresso. Maybe a splash of water on the face, a palmful of vitamins, but mostly buzzing around the house on espresso, dictionary and atlas open on the rug, the typewriter waiting for the key of the head, a cello on the radio, and, if necessary, the windows, trees, 50, 100 years old out there, heavy clouds on the way, and the lawn steaming like a horse in the early morning.
Billy Collins, The First Dream and Morning, off his CD, The Best Cigarette. That's our show. So this is David Oates saying goodbye, and thanks for listening to Wordland. May this be a better year than 2020.
Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com.